you put a piece of rag inside your pan of your gun, and then put the top of the pan down where the percussion cap goes on, down, and a piece of rag over that, and cover it up. This in daylight. So when you go down at night, and you can hear the ducks are there, you know the feel of the gun, you unwrap your gun, you take, we used to use the top of a thigh boot to cover the gun up.
Yeah.
Which was rubber, waterproof, and a couple of sacks over that, and a couple of bricks to hold it down so it didn't blow off and get wet. Because that's the main thing with punt gunning, you must have the powder perfectly dry, everything perfectly, the gun perfectly dry. I learned that after a few mistakes. You uncover your gun if you hear the ducks are there, take your piece of rag out of your pan, fold your pan back, pull out your feather, and lay your gun slightly to the left, pour in from here. Usually carry it in your top pocket, a priming horn, which has got your fine powder in, a little antlers horn, holds about a few ounces of priming powder. You only need about a teaspoonful anyway to prime a gun. And a cork of the priming horn is a little piece of wood or a piece of cork with a lady's hat pin or a hair pin in, the size of your touch hole in your barrel. So you pour your powder into the pan near the touch hole, put your, feel your way in the dark, this is, with your pin, feel the touch hole and keep poking the powder in, and draw your finger across the top of the pan to make sure there's no surface powder where your top of your pan lid comes down. You can feel that, you can feel your fine powder, this is in the dark. Bring your top down with a percussion cap nipple on the top down, make sure that's perfectly safe and firm. Take out your little waistcoat pocket, we used to carry little caps in the waistcoat pocket, and put the cap on. Your gun is already on half cock. And then when you listen again, the ducks are still splashing and quacking away. You put your cap on, pull the gun up cock, you keep to the left-hand side, which is away from the pan. You lay on the left-hand side and listen, and then you'll be about, say, a foot or 2 foot away, and your hand, your right hand, just hit the trigger, and you get a flash in the pan, and boom, goes the gun. You walk over a plank, because you're the opposite side of the ditch, to where the field is flooded, because you can't cross the ditch to get to your gun, so you always put it on the opposite side of the ditch, in a higher part. Have a torch, but when I first started using a bank gun, I had an old gas lamp, carbine lamp. So turn the water on and get the thing going and strike a match and get the gas and walk and pick up what you've shot. I have had an average of 10 or 15 mallard of a night on the frost.
Oh, that's good going.
And I've had 16 dead ones lay in the hole, every one completely on the backs, dead.
Good Lord.
And the trouble is that shooting it in dark, you never know where all your cripples have gone. So the next morning you're up early, take your dog, you go around and pick your cripples up. Perhaps you've got one lay on the ice dead before the cairn crows or black-backed gulls get them. If you've got a cripple, creep away. They don't go very far in a ditch. And you usually go for the ditch, hide up, take your dog, or walk around and find them. But when you're shooting from the punt, you have to stalk your prey.
It's a different ball game.
It's a different thing altogether. Your gun is to gun is lying on the bank, on the barrier bank or on the crash bank, all depends on the height of the flood. And you lay your gun down on some on a piece of wood and wrap your piece of thigh boot round it and some sacks round it and another piece of cloth. Then you turn your punt upside down and cover your complete gun up. So your gun is on the cover, upside down, your boat.
Really well protected.
Go down in the early morning, turn your boat up the right way, slide it into the water, load your gun, load your budget. A budget is what you carry all your shot and powder and a little gravel whiskey if you can afford it. But you'll need something when you're laying a punt for about 3 hours. A little gravel whiskey or brandy or something in the bottle just to warm you up a bit. And if you're a bit late, it's daylight or it's just breaking light, you've got to know by the, I usually tell by the watermark at at Welney Bridge, how high the water was, say it was 104, 105, whichever it was, I could tell which field I could get in through a low place where there's a splash, because mallard and widgeon like fleet water, they don't like deep water.
Yeah.
And you can't hold a boat in the wind in deep water anyway.
Yeah.
So you've got to know your area.
Very well.
You know every inch of it, more or less, the low places. And these old punt gunners years ago made these low places by hand with the shovels in the summer, so they knew where to go in the winter time. They knew where they could get through.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
they got caught out a lot by stalking ducks, and when they got within 200 yards of them, they couldn't get no further because there was a little ridge in the way. So they dug places out so they could get the punt through, because the punt would go through about 6 inches of water.
Yeah.
But anyway, sometimes I used to go down the bank, behind the bank, and pop my head up and see where the best flocks were. But it's much different than what it is now. They float in the evening and they float out in the morning, back to the coast.
Yeah.
They come in to wash up in fresh water and feed, and then go back in the morning. If there wasn't many about, probably a lot of mallard would stay behind, and we always went for mallard. And if we could kill 20 widgeon or 8 or 9 mallard, you'd go for the mallard.
Yeah.
They sold better.
Yeah.
It didn't cost them much to send away, and everybody would buy mallard. They wouldn't buy the widgeon. And the markets liked the mallard better, and they made more money for us.
Yeah.
So we didn't go for big kills.
You selected your prize.
We selected what we wanted. And as I say, sometimes you'd go down the bank and you'd have a look. If you're lucky enough, I had a look enough to have a pair of binoculars and find out where the best place was to go, where the best ducks were. And you'd have a shoot in the morning, and the shoot in the afternoon. That's all the shooting you've done. You wouldn't allow anyone to stand around your splash of water or shoot on your area before the war, I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Because they'd disturb all the ducks for your punt gunning.
Yeah.
But after the war, it got much different. A lot of farmers who owned the land, their sons won a bit of wildfowling, and punt gunning became, well, a useless hobby.
Yeah. Yeah.
You just couldn't earn any money at it.
Yeah.
And that's how I become a member of a shooting syndicate, or we started a shooting syndicate to control the shooting much better. Got round everybody and said, look, if you're going tonight and somebody's going tomorrow night, it's going to be overshot, it's going to drive all the birds away. Let's form a syndicate.
Yeah, this is the way to go about
it. Some of the land I have the shooting rights on, and some I don't, and that I don't have the shooting rights on, hire it, and we'll all get together and we'll shoot. No shooting Monday and Tuesdays. Everybody has to be off by 10 o'clock in the morning. Nobody goes until an hour and a half before sunset at night, and must be off an hour and a half after sunset. We don't believe in shooting all through the night on the moon. Have your flight, hour and a half or hour's flight, and away.
Yeah.
And it pays off double.
Yeah.
And that's how I became interested in wildfowling. And then, of course, in 1967-68, I heard the news that the Wildfowl Trust had bought 100 acres of land where I had the shooting rights on. And the very next day, I met Peter Scott, and he said they wanted to start a refuge. And Welney, this end of Welney, was the most suitable place. But already the RSPB had started one on the south side of Welney Road. And I met Peter Scott, and he understood that my livelihood was wildfowling and shepherding cattle. He asked me if I was willing to give up the 100 acres of land which I'd already got for the following season, 100 acres shooting rights. Would I give it up, because they just bought it and they was told that I'd got the shooting rights for the next year? I said, well, you put your cards on the table and I'll put mine on. What's the situation? What's the future coming out of it? But we're trying to get 400 to 500 acres, a block of land on the washes, and make a refuge. Within a half an hour talking to him, he asked me if I'd be their warden. And from that day onwards, I haven't shot a gun, 12 ball. I've only shot a 2.2 rifle for vermin.
Yeah, so that completely changed.
I completely changed from one thing and the other, but as I say before, several times people say to me, how could you leave off shooting when you've never you was never dressed without a gun during the shooting season.
Yeah.
Well, it's different. It's much easier for me to give up than it is anyone who does it for sport.
Yeah.
Because I'm paid to carry binoculars now, and I used to have to work like hell with a punt gun and ride about with a bicycle and walk all over the land to shoot enough to keep me going in the winter.
Yeah.
So it's much easier to be the other way around.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong, I'm not against shooting or anything like that. If shooting is run correctly, the shooting, warfowling, WAGB's a good thing, the warfowl clubs are a very good thing. As long as it's well organised.
Yeah.
And I've nothing against it at all. I still run the shooting syndicate. The warfowl trust is not against warfowling, providing it's done in a proper manner.
Yeah.
There's room in this world for everybody, providing it's organised.
Yeah, but it's the control of those who sort of abuse the privilege, isn't it?
Well, it is. It's people who go out, they've probably got permission to go on a certain person's land, but they've got no idea of what wildfowling's about. I mean, I can go down any time now. I know people's going wildfowling this week. And I can go and look in that field and I'll find plover been shot.
Yeah, yeah.
They don't even know what bird they're shooting at.
That's not the way.
It's not the way to... They ought to be... WAGB does a good job with training young warfowlers.
Yeah.
Giving them warfowling courses. Yeah. Now, if all clubs done that... But, you see, the whole thing I'm against is some person hiring or buying a field, putting water on it, and advertising it, wildfowling, good wildfowling, £5 a day or £6 a day. Well, these people who realise or think that there's some good wildfowling there, they pay their £5 or £6, £10, whichever it is, they go, and there's no ducks to be seen. They get bored stiff, they paid the money, so anything what flies they have a go at.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what spoils it.
Yeah.
You can't really blame them, they've paid the money, and they've been told by the advert that there's plenty of ducks there.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm against.
Yeah. Well, didn't you some time ago have a go with a four bore?
Yes, I had four shots with a four bore. Well, actually five. One because they said I didn't fire the damn thing. And it belonged to my uncle, Will Kent, one of the real old typical fenmen. He was a wildfowler, a shepherd, eel catcher, hive maker, grig maker, and made his own plover nets, eel nets, and he could go ditching in the bottom of a ditch. He could throw the earth out left-handed or right-handed. I think he was the only man in the fens I knew who could do that.
Really?
And I went nights and trained, and now I can do the same. Now I still think I'm the only one who can hot ever take a draw or a 6 inches of earth out of the bottom of the dike, throw it out to my right hand side, or throw it out, use my other hand out the left hand side.
Yeah, it takes a bit of skill, doesn't it?
And he had a four bore. And when we first started this wildfowl syndicate, he said, "Why don't you take my four bore and try it?" And the syndicate all roared with laughter and said, "He daren't fire the damn thing, it's too big and heavy for him." And I said, "Well, I know I damn well can." So my uncle gave me a cartridge, and this was at night, dark. And we went out the pub, and I fired into the bank. And I said, "There, I know I fired the damn thing. Don't think I'm frightened of it." And we went down, and the wash, that same week, I think, and there was a lot of pink-footed geese coming that year. And we was in a line. The wind was in the south. And we always stand back wind, or when there's a flood, it's impossible to put hides up, because if they're not permanent, the ducks shy off them. So we never built hides when the flood was rising. So we just crouch down and keep your face down, and also get against a gatepost or an old bush or something. One thing in wildfowling where people do wrong, they set down and they're looking in the sky all the time. Now, I never done that when I done fly shooting.
Really?
Never look in the sky. Always look down and close your eyes. Look to the floor and close your eyes. And listen. And when you can hear the wings beat, You open your eyes, and there, whatever bird it is, it's a black spot in the sky as plain as light. But if you're staring around, you always, they fly by and you don't see them. But always have your head down, looking on the ground, or close your eyes and listen. Whether they're coming headwind or backwind, you'll always hear the wing beat. And very often you can tell whether they're pintail, shovel, teal, or what they are. And that's why there's so many swans get shot. Because people say, oh, that couldn't be a swan because we couldn't hear it. But a wild swan, a Berwick swan, and a Hooper swan hasn't got a wing beat at all. You can't hear them fly. Where a mute swan, you can hear them all off.
Yeah.
That's why wild fellas shoot wild swans, because they think as long as there's no wing beat, they must be geese.
Yeah.
There is a slight amount of wing beat on a goose, but anything white in the dark shines up black in the sky if you've got your eyes closed and then open them up. It's a black spot in the sky.
Yeah, yeah.
But going back to the forebore, we was down this particular night, and this flock of geese was coming. We heard them coming very, very slow because there was a gale force wind blowing, and there was a line of us stretching right across the field, and as long as I got the forebore, I said, everyone else have their shots and I'll be the last one to shoot. So we was out shooting, and hearts beating like hell. You could see the geese coming. It was a bit of a break in the cloud, and there was a bit of moon, and everybody was saying, they're not coming up, they're not coming up. And last of all, they really come straight for us, well in range of everybody. So I said, everybody fire, and then I'll fire last because I got the strongest gun. And they all fired, and I forget how many geese, I think there were 7 or 8 geese killed in that particular shot. And one of the geese broke away over me and the other gun next to me. I won't mention no name, but he had a 16 bore and I had the 4 bore. And this one particular goose broke over in between the two of us. And I knew it was well out of his range, and it was just about in the range of the forebore. And he fired his first shot, and as he fired his second, I fired my shot. And it was well dead above me, and as I fired, I let the forebore go, and it stuck in the earth behind me because I couldn't hold it. And he said, I got a goose, I got a goose. I said, well, I think I hit that one. I don't think you did, he said. I said, all right, being friends, I said, you have it. We went back to the pub, and my uncle said, how did you get on? I said, well, I got half a goose, I think. He said, what do you mean, got a half a goose? I said, well, so-and-so was next to me, and he fired one shot, and as he fired his second one, I fired at the same time, and he claimed that he killed it, and I thought I killed it. So he said to my friend, he said, what card did you use? And he said, number 4s. He said, well, the forebore, all the cartridges I hand load are BBs, and let's have the goose and have a look. So we got the goose and put it on the table, and he got his penknife out and a few feathers, and he couldn't find a number 4 shot in a goose nowhere. There was all BBs. And that was the end of that.
That claimed your goose, didn't it?
That claimed that the forebore, and that, I think that was 4 geese I killed with that, with 4 shots. I actually fired the gun 5 times, but I killed 4 geese.
That's pretty efficient shooting, isn't it?
Well, that was a real good gun. I only wish I'd been able to get a hold of it.
Yeah, absolute gem. Yeah.